Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak about the last desperate and dirty tactics in this closing election cycle that the McCain campaign appear to be resorting to through surrogates, and whether or not it will be in any way effective. And of course, the contradictory polls that most people cite, giving Obama a substantial lead and a possible sweep, in contrast to polling, internal polling, which the McCain campaign claims to have, that indicates something different. We'll be speaking with Joe Connison, who is a journalist, best-selling author, and political commentator. He's the national correspondent for the New York Observer and a weekly columnist for the Observer and for Salon.com. And he's the director of the Nation Institute's Investigative Fund and a former investigative editor for the American Prospect magazine. So we'll be talking to him, and then we'll talk with Ron Suskin, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist whose coverage and analysis of the Bush administration has been acclaimed for its unique insight. He is author of a number of books, including the bestsellers The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, The White House, and The Education of Paul O'Neill, and The 1% Doctrine. His new book is The Way of the World, which we've had on this discussed earlier on this program. And he, of course, Suskin has developed a kind of unified theory of everything, which asserts that the same Bush-Cheney ideology that led to war and ruined America's strategic position internationally is also a central factor, which has led to the financial catastrophe that has devastated America's and the world's economy. And then we'll talk about the outsider who was picked by insiders, Sarah Palin. We'll look into the selection of Sarah Palin, whose negatives continue to grow. Every time she appears in any kind of press interview, her poll numbers go down. Of course, she's yet to have a press conference, probably for the reason being that she would be totally wiped off the map if she was exposed to the press. So we're looking into the people that chose her and lobbied for her and the extent to which she's been a liability for John McCain, but nevertheless has political ambitions for 2012. I'm now speaking with Joe Connison, who is a journalist, best-selling author, and political commentator. He is a national correspondent for the New York Observer and a weekly columnist for the Observer and for Salon.com. He's the director of the Nation Institute's Investigative Fund and the former investigative editor of the American Prospect magazine. His books include Big Lies, The Right-Wing Propaganda Machine, and How It Distorts the Truth, and Raw Deal, How the Bush Republicans Plan to Destroy Social Security and the Legacy of the New Deal. His most recent book is It Can Happen Here, Authoritarian Peril in the Age of Bush. His writings and reporting have appeared in many publications, including Harper's, The Guardian, The Nation, and The New Republic. And Joe Connison, Joe the journalist, I'm speaking with Joe the journalist, as opposed to John McCain's imaginary friend, Joe the plumber. Do you think this sort of nauseating display of faux populism that the Republicans are trying to dress up their campaign with is in any way working?
You know, Ian, I think it has an effect on base voters of theirs. In other words, the people who already are likely to vote Republican and be active Republicans, I think are inspired by a story like Joe the Plumber kind of telling off Barack Obama, or a symbol like that. Even though it turns out that he's not what he appeared to be or not what he said he was, that doesn't really matter.
And the story
so much of what they do is symbolic rather than based in what we call the reality-based community. They're not into that. So, yes, I think it does have an effect. It also it has another effect, which is it breaks through a little bit for them on the economic issue. In other words, it creates a noise that competes with the message that Obama's trying to send. So I think it wasn't ineffective. I don't think it's going to win, likely to win any states for them, but I think it helped them a bit.
So are we just victims of this era that we're in, where belief is more important than fact and data doesn't necessarily work with people who have a rigid belief system, because the actual ambush of Obama, the entire exchange with Joe the Plumber is quite different from the way that it's been cast. It's pretty clear that he was a plant. And it's also pretty clear that he's completely off the wall. Even Fox News, Shepard Smith, their anchor, interviewed him and was absolutely disgusted with him because he refused to reveal his sources on these wild charges that Obama was out to destroy Israel.
Right. Yes. I mean, look, I always say to people who worry about the audience that's receptive to Joe the Plumber is, don't worry about them, because that is and always has been a minority of the public and even of the voting public. The people you need to worry about are the people who are somewhere closer to the center than that, who could be swayed either way. And I think the test in this election will be, you know, how small a minority is it that is susceptible to that? Because I think unless the polling data is way off, people are much less receptive to that than they have been in the last, you know, 25 years. So, again, I know that's a dangerously optimistic assertion, but it seems to me that this kind of thing is not working as well as it once did. And the reason is very simple, by the way, Ian, which is people are experiencing reality. And reality is unpleasant now in a lot of ways, and it has been during this past 8 years. So, you know... People often discover that an ideology is bankrupt only when they find out firsthand what the effects of it are. We discover this over and over again under Bush.
So as McCain and Sarah Palin tout Joe the Plumber, they appear to be, at least Palin appears to be losing the center and the independents in a big way. She's, I think, a negative at 58, 59.
Right.
And every time she does any kind of interview, particularly the Katie Couric interview, her poll numbers dropped dramatically. And if she ever did a press conference, which they've avoided at all cost, I think she'd be pretty much finished, because this is somebody that they simply can't afford to allow, except under these kind of press conditions, which shows you how bankrupt our press is. ABC did a piece on 2020 with Elizabeth Vargas that was clearly prescribed and contained within the parameters of why she'd agree to go on in the first place. And it was an absolute travesty and a disgrace. But clearly, this is a case where somebody who is not being exposed to the public, and it's a very cynical situation. And I'm surprised that the Democrats haven't been able to, or the press itself doesn't have any kind of professional responsibility and sense of its own role here. I mean, Fox News, for example, created a guerrilla campaign to force Obama to come on Fox News. So why hasn't people in the press demanded that the American people get to meet Sarah Palin for real?
You know, there's been some sporadic protests from people in the press about the way they've handled Palin in this campaign. But frankly, I think we've kind of seen the limits of the Republican style of media management here, because her poll numbers are falling. And it's clear to everyone, she's such an embarrassment that their own people have been forced to admit she's unprepared and have jumped ship. I mean, people, you know, you wouldn't expect from David Brooks and Lawrence Eagleburger, the former Secretary of State who McCain mentioned on TV the other night is endorsing him, finally came out the other day and said, you know, he could not be dishonest about this and say she was prepared for this job. She did not.
But then he had to reverse himself the next day on Fox News.
Well, they do that. But but nevertheless, the truth comes out.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's what affects people's perceptions of this in the campaign. She's turned out to be a tremendous liability. And, you know, I have to say, it's one of the few things I was right about this year, I guess, which is I knew she was going to be a problem from the minute he picked her, because it was such a bad reflection on his judgment. You know, even at the convention, you know, in St. Paul, I was sitting there with a bunch of, you know, other journalists, and they're sort of astonished at how well she's doing in her with her speech, and, you know, oh, this is it. It's going to be a big problem for them. This flash in the pan will end, because I by that point I knew a little about her record in Alaska, and there were big problems there too. this is an example of the limits of how much you can manage the story, even with a press that's as supine as ours usually is.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Joe Connison, the journalist, best-selling author, and political commentator, and we're talking about the closing hours of this campaign, days, and there is, I think, pretty clearly more and more stuff. In fact, Obama a few days ago mentioned or perhaps inoculated against the possibility of some pretty scurrilous attacks. They seem to be coming out. I've seen some of these Republican surrogate commercials about the Reverend Wright. So is this pretty much going to be the legacy of John McCain, these last-minute desperation of flinging dirt?
I guess so. I mean, it's a shame because, you know, I know him a little bit over the last 8 years since he first ran for president. As a journalist, I've interviewed him a few times and met him. And I have to tell you, he was, almost anybody who's dealt with him will tell you, he's a much more likable and intelligent man than he seems to be. I'm not going to say anything about his integrity because I'm afraid he's proved otherwise, but in this campaign, but he's also come to seem to me in this campaign as if he's not very bright. And that's not what I thought of him before. And I think it's a shame. It's a sad thing. Other people are just angry at him, and I think they're right to be angry at the way he's run this campaign. But I think there's an element of tragedy in this as well.
Well, I suppose the tragedy then, if you want to do some forensics on it, it's pretty obvious that Palin was the kiss of death, and he apparently wanted Lieberman, and he was overruled, which is hard to believe that your employees can
Lieberman. Lieberman would have been awful in a different way, but.
Right. Well, he may have been a little.
But it would have shown greater integrity on his part. Yes.
Right.
No question about that.
Well, it's possible that it would have been more competitive race too. It's assuming that, as most polls indicate, that this could well be a substantial sweep for Obama. At least
it would have been a very strange race, and I'll tell you why. Because Joe Lieberman's record, as repellent as I think he is in a lot of ways, his record on domestic issues is very liberal. His voting record. Very liberal, and especially in terms of the Republican Party. That's why McCain couldn't pick him, mm-hmm. because his voting record is anathema to the rank-and-file Republicans on everything from choice to the environment to labor issues, many, 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 many things. It's hard to see how he would have run as the running mate of this very conservative Republican without having to do the most incredible gyrations ideologically and on the issues that I think would have also been an embarrassment to him and to the ticket. So I don't know what would have happened.
Sure. Well, there's also Mitt Romney, though, isn't there? I mean,
I think they're very sorry they didn't pick Mitt Romney.
Right. And he would have at least been able to say that he knew something about the economy.
Right. Exactly. Yes.
Although perhaps he's could have been painted as the poster boy for Wall Street. Although I don't think he didn't take much of a bath, did he? From what I understand,
I think he did okay.
Yeah.
But he would have been, the issue that would have been used against him is outsourcing of jobs and
right.
cutting people's employment, which was a problem for him when he first started to run for president. He has a record in Bain Capital doing that kind of thing, and I think in this climate that could have become a big liability. So they all have problems, but none of them have the negatives of Sarah Palin, because at least, you know, Mitt Romney can talk about issues. You might not agree with him, but he's an intelligent man who's been in public life for many years, and obviously Lieberman is capable of discussing things too. Sarah Palin can't put together three coherent sentences about any policy.
Mm. Well, as the race closes now, Joe Connison, and it appears that the polling this pretty overwhelmingly suggests a substantial victory for Obama. You understand why the McCain people are saying that they're closing. They're closing. What else are they going to say? They've got to keep their morale up. It's not clear on the
Hi, big boy.
It's not.
My son just walked in.
Okay. Well. Let's hope we could keep him amused for the last minute here.
He's going.
clearly, though, that the House and Senate. The House will get a big pickup. The Senate, I don't think it's going to get there to the 60. And we're going to be talking later with Nate Silver about this.
60 seats was kind of a dream.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, you don't usually get that in a single election. In fact, you almost never get that anyway.
Right.
So that was a dream. But, you know, Ian, they don't really need 60 seats. What they need is enough seats to be able to say to the few remaining endangered semi-moderate Republicans who are going to be in the Senate come January, you better stand with us because you're out the next time if you don't. And that message will be powerful.
You don't think the alternative, which will be to sabotage and to take advantage of all the economic dislocation and despair that will be happening as the economy melts down further?
No, I hope that we'll have the kind of leadership from the White House where they'll be able to say to a Susan Collins or an Olympia Snow or anybody who's remaining in the Northwest, look, you know, you really don't want to filibuster against the measures that we're going to take to try to improve people's health care and put them back to work.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you do, I'm coming after you.
Now, that does make sense. Just in closing then, Joe Connison, what happened to Al Franken? He was way ahead in the polls, and it's closed down towards the end here. He's one of the seats that's in doubt or that whether or not. And Coleman seemed to be very beatable. I know you're often on the Al Franken show, so I assume you know the guy.
What? Yes, Al's a very good friend. Frankly, I had my doubts about whether he should do this in the first place because I didn't think that Coleman was very beatable. I thought Coleman would be a very tough opponent. If you go back and look at the polls, they've sort of been up and down in this whole race. I mean, Al, neither of them has had a consistent lead, and I think Al has run a very good race, and I still think he can win. The last poll I saw a few days ago had him 4 up, which is, you know, within the margin of error, but certainly within striking distance of a victory. And I think it's going to depend a lot on two factors in that race. One is the number of voters who vote for Dean Barkley, who's the independent candidate, rather than Coleman. And the second is...
Is he a libertarian or is he a Green?
You know, he's neither one. He's a Jesse Ventura guy. Radical centrist, I guess, or something. I don't know really what he is.
So he's going to take votes from the Republican, you think?
He could take votes from both to some degree, but I think he may take a bit more from Coleman because he's a protest candidate against people who don't want to vote for an incumbent, most likely. And the other factor, of course, is the Obama margin in Minnesota. If Barack Obama wins Minnesota by a big enough margin, and it looks like he's going to do that in the next day or so, then people up there some Republicans just may not bother to vote, and that could harm Coleman a lot.
Will that also harm Michelle Bachmann?
Well, you know, you keep your fingers crossed.
Well, there would be some justice getting rid of her.
Yes, her and the other one is Liddy Dole. I'm looking at that one.
Right.
For proof. Proof of the existence of the Almighty.
Yeah, that the old adage that nice guys finish last is not necessarily written in stone here in our political culture.
I hope not.
Well, just as a last thought, though, about since you're Joe the journalist as opposed to Joe the plumber.
He had to be named Joe, didn't he?
John McCain's imaginary friend.
The imaginary friend.
What do you think is going to happen, though, in an Obama administration? It seems to be the landscape's being laid out here for possibly an ugly turn where you recall, and I know you worked on this a lot, on the permanent campaign against Clinton. There's always been this notion of in American politics that the winner wins and the loser goes off and licks their wounds. 4 years later, comes back with a better argument. It's, you know, in the tradition of the Yale debates that Bill Buckley used to have with George McGovern. That all ended with Clinton. A group of billionaires decided, actually a small group led by Richard Mellon Scaife, they weren't going to accept his legitimacy as an elected president,
right.
And they were going to conduct a guerrilla war against him to diminish his ability to govern.
Well, you know, Scaife is still around, and Newsmax, his site, is doing some of the dirtiest stuff. I mean, I wrote a column about this for Salon this weekend, about what I think will happen in the beginning of the Obama administration, and I think, you know, it's going to be... pitched war. The thing that Obama has going for him, aside from his incredible political skills, which Clinton also had, is that the ideology that is seeking to neuter him or destroy him has been discredited. That wasn't true for Clinton. When Clinton came to power in the White House, conservatism was still at or near its zenith as an ideology. That is not the case anymore. And I think in that sense, Obama has to realize it's going to be an ideological struggle, and which I think he does. I mean, if you listen to his speeches in the last couple of weeks, he does talk about the exhausted ideology of conservatism and doing something different. And I think he needs to sharpen that, because that's what it's going to be about in January.
I was just going to suggest, that, just in closing, Joe Connison, that rather than a top-down approach to discredit an incumbent like Richard Mellenscaife's billions were used to harass Clinton, I see a bottom-up kind of approach here, where the ground game, the people that Palin's brought out of the woodwork, are going to be very unhappy, and there's going to be a lot of righteous rage on the right.
You know, that will only be effective if Obama and the Democrats disappoint the great mass of Americans who are waiting for them to do something, to see if they will do something.
And well, they got a hell of a job on their hands.
My hope is that when Obama returns to the Senate as the president-elect in a few weeks, that, or if he does, I hope he does, he will begin to work on legislation that can be then delivered to his desk as soon as he's in the White House, that he can sign, for example, establishing a 90-day moratorium on foreclosures and some other measures that would create immediate action.
Well,
on
I thank
the economy.
I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Joe Connison.
Thank you.
Bye bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Joe Connison, journalist, bestselling author, and political commentator. I'm now speaking with Ron Suskin, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and journalist whose coverage and analysis of the Bush administration has been acclaimed for its unique insight. Ron Suskin is the author of a number of books, including the bestsellers The Price of Loyalty, George W. Bush, The White House, and The Education of Paul O'Neill, and The 1% Doctrine. His new book is The Way of the World. And Ron Suskin, your unified theory of everything is... indicates here that the Bush-Cheney ideology that's led to war and ruined America's strategic position internationally is also a central factor that's led to the financial catastrophe that's devastated America's and the world's economy. Do you think that we are heading into a kind of deja vu of FDR in 1932?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Ian, because I think these cultural sort of shifts, you know, they're slow in how they take hold, but often when they do, they cause extraordinary changes in the American landscape. And I think that over time, people have heard about and seen much of what defined the Bush administration, but they're really feeling it now. They're feeling it in their pocketbooks and their 401ks. They're feeling it in America's diminished status around the world, the loss of trust here and abroad in our institutions, which is certainly the source of our character, in many cases our power. And I think you're going to see a real shift. You know, I think the best way to sort of think about this period, and some of it was a culmination of periods past, was a kind of idea of confidence. The Bush administration led a kind of confidence man's approach, if you will, believing in the mystical powers of will, of a kind of certainty. Don't blink, full steam ahead, things will work out, and if they don't, well, by then we'll be off to the next thing.
Well,
that, of course, has affected our economy, it's affected our position in the world, it's been something that's been, as I said, something of a unified field theory of disaster.
Well, I guess if that's the case, then the Bush's sort of legacy would be Sarah Palin, because she's repeating all of that kind of certainty. The mission, not I won't blink, and all of that kind of stuff. And she appears to be actually dragging McCain down, if you're based upon leaks from within the top ranks of the McCain campaign.
Well, you know, the fact is, I think she's drafting right off his shoulder. She has sized it up. She's got apparently very strong political instincts. She's got a kind of tactical clarity, to be frank. She probably looked at the terrain and said, this white-haired guy is dead and buried, and his crowd as well, and I will lead the charge of the true Americans of the base, which is still out there. Its heart's beating. They'll probably be in the wilderness here for a time, but under Palin, raring to come back stronger and more ferocious than ever. These issues are not new issues. They are parts of the various impulses inside of the American character. Between the gambler's ethos, between faith-based ideas, between this notion of who's the authentic American and who is not, as well as the sort of counterpoints of prudence, of enlightenment principles, of the notion that reason, deliberation, good process, if you will get us to good answers at the end of the day, embracing people who seem to have nothing in common with you, whether it's race or ethnicity. All of these things have been at war for many, many years, centuries even, inside of America, and they are fighting it out now in these days prior to this election and will, I think, up ahead as well.
So will she therefore lead a right-wing insurgency, or will it be sufficiently discredited that somebody like Romney will be the standard bearer for the party?
Well, my gut tells me that she will have strength, and that white right-wing insurgency of that base will have strength, especially if Obama, if he is elected, is not able to turn the country around in significant and measurable ways on some very core issues of well-being, especially the economy and our place in the world. Both of those things are going to be very, very difficult, even for a president with lots of tailwind, lots of momentum, and the best ideas, because they portend a restructuring of the way America has done business for many, many years. And the fact is, Obama's presidency, if he becomes president, as the polls indicate, but for any president now, the key is to show it is not business as usual in America. And that's for both of the domestic and foreign consumer, if you will. And that's going to be tough for Obama to do. He's going to have to show extraordinary discipline as a leader, as well as a kind of force of imagination, which I think is the missing ingredient over the recent years. I write about this in At the End of the Way of the World, which ultimately ends up being something of a hopeful book in terms of how Americans, from the top to the bottom, are using some of the harrowing disclosures and certainties, the things that we've seen over the past few years, as a kind of starting point, as to where we go from here to repair America's moral authority. And the key is that line, a failure of imagination. You remember that's what the 9/11 Commission mm-hmm. says was the key to us not imagining the mendacity, the ingenuity, and destructiveness of our enemies. Well, in fact, now it is as well a failure of imagination, which is our vulnerability, a failure to imagine the country we might yet become, and to essentially lead the world in that song. That's a kind of leadership we have really discarded, sadly. That the world is all but saying, please, do that again. That's you at your best. And Obama may be able to manage that. That's going to be the key trick. Can he do it and bring America with him?
But Ron Suskin, do you think that we will enter a new political era, in as much as it seems that, you know, the parliamentary systems, you have your elections and then you form your coalitions if you don't get an outright majority. In our winner-take-all system, the Founding Fathers envisioned that the coalitions were formed before the elections. And what seems to happen in this country is that we put so much energy and effort into voting and the campaign, and they spent a couple of billion on this one, that people sort of treat politics as rather like going to the dentist. It's something you do out of duty, and you do your duty as voting. Voting is your duty, but not the follow-on, not the forming of the coalition, not keeping their feet to the fire, not millions of people going to Washington with Obama. And I think unless millions of people, either perhaps in a virtual way, go to Washington with Obama and create the kind of lobby that he needs, inexorably the special interests will take over and he will fail.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that's a very trenchant point, Ian, is that people use this vote every two, or especially every 4 years, as a kind of proxy for actual engagement in their democracy. You know, in our system, of course, as you say, it is the people who are sovereign. It is we who are the bosses to guide our ship of state. Public servant is, of course, the term of art. They are awesomely powerful, but they are our servants. And what's interesting now is whether we will see a change with so much at stake, and that being clear now to so many people, both in terms of America's status here at home, our health, in terms of the pursuit of happiness, our economy, security, financial, and our security in terms of where we find ourselves in a roiling and dangerous world. will they say, you know, I've got to stay involved here? You know, Obama has run something of an insurgency. You know, all of those credit card clicks that brought him all of that money, all of the army that's out there now. The big question is, what do you do after Election Day, like that old movie? So, well, what do we do now? Well, part of what Obama, I think, is probably thinking about is what will I do with that army? How will I keep them moving along a line, hopefully, of a new direction for the country? You know, one of the things he does talk about is this sort of the army of sort of humanitarian muscle that hopefully will be sent out into the world as well as fan out here in America. You know, he's talked about giving the $4,000 college credit in exchange for public service here or abroad. I think that's part of an attempt. There will be others, I'm sure, to harness the enthusiasm of people saying, this is my democracy, I own it, and what can I do to make it what it ought to be?
And Ron Suskin, given that the economy hasn't melted down perhaps to the bottom, I think a lot of economists I've spoken to suggest that there are other shoes that may drop. The people with variables will start being foreclosed on after the subprime meltdown works its way through. Then there's the next wave, if you will, is the variables, and then all the way that people have kept pace is through credit cards, and they're starting to foreclose on credit cards as well now. So if we have a continuing domestic economic meltdown, and already indications are that this economy that depends, at least two-thirds of this economy depends upon people going to the mall, and there are indications that people aren't going to the mall. And then in the foreign policy arena, you have the real prospect of having to extricate the United States from this catastrophe in Iraq and Afghanistan, where we appear to have lost in Iraq and are in the process of losing in Afghanistan. Those already Palin is talking about waving the white flag of surrender. So I could foresee a situation where Obama doesn't have the luxury of a foreign policy, is branded as the guy that sold us out and snatched our victory in Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, Republicans argue still about how Jack Kennedy didn't order that final aircraft carrier squadron to take off in the Bay of Pigs, which is a complete myth. But right. And who lost China and who lost Vietnam? So I'm laying out a scenario here of somebody that's going to be besieged.
Oh, no doubt. There's no doubt he will be. He will be tested as I think no leader in our lifetime has been tested when he, manages on Tuesday to step up onto that stage. You know, it's interesting. He does have advantages because he speaks not just of a kind of political next step, but in some ways he speaks clearly of how the nation has changed as an African-American who is in our nation's highest office. And essentially an emblem to the world as to what America represents, that it is still a work in progress, that there is still forward motion. Do you want to be a part of that? That's a question mark that I think we'll offer to the world. I think their response will be yes. You know, part of it is that Obama will have to move quickly while he has momentum to do everything he can do to really start some of these changes, such that it'll be difficult to stand in front of that moving train. That's going to be the key for him, no doubt about it. Because if he stops in the water just like a shark, he is prey. He needs to keep moving and to keep pushing, you know, because the knives are very sharp. And ultimately, Obama needs to, when you talk about the economy or any president at this moment, needs to do something extraordinary, which is in a way restore a kind of idea where prudence is rewarded, which there have been eras like that in the economic life of America, after all, where prudent behavior, wise leadership, a kind of prudent man, Samuel Putnam, old Boston investors philosophy, actually that was the thing that was most prized. And it created a slower but steadier kind of economic fabric and framework, and as well it trickled down and guided people at all levels of their behavior as economic beings in the country. That is, at this point, distant and dusty memory. In some key way, Obama needs to, if he becomes president, restore that, because that ultimately gives us a kind of staying power that frankly, is part of our tradition economically, as opposed to a, you know, Binion's Las Vegas kind of roll the dice, keep moving, don't blink, you know, and what does my lawyer tell me I can get away with? You know, ultimately, that kind of Enron model, which, of course, is filtered all through the economy, I mean, frankly, all the way down to the bottom, people with their 401ks or their mutual funds, what were they asking? What is my return? That's all. I don't want to know more. You know, frankly, it's too complex for my easy comprehension. I'm assuming someone's watching the store. No, they weren't. You know, I think that we are at a point where we might actually mature as a country, which is parts of what civilizations do, to say, okay, what is it that is our core? Certain values, ideas, standards, just common sense that has been what has worked when things have worked. How do we hold tight to them? How do we restore them to the center place as opposed to the periphery of American life? And in both our conduct here in America, our economic conduct, our conduct, you know, in terms of civil rights and rule of law, as well as what we show by example to the world. That's the big question now. Can America self-correct? Are the self-correcting processes intact? Will the next president be able to hold those machines, guide them, crank them up, and help the ship of state turn on a dime in a very, very new direction, despite all you mentioned, Ian, in terms of what some of the mendacious rhythms of Washington, self-interested rather than of shared interest, will be dictating.
I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles today, Ron Suskin.
Well, my pleasure.
Bye-bye. And welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Jane Mayer, who's a Washington-based staff writer for The New Yorker, specializing in political and investigative reporting. Before that, she was a senior writer and front-page editor for The Wall Street Journal, as well as the journal's first female White House correspondent. Her new book, a New York Times bestseller, is The Dark Side, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals, which has been described as a chronicle of one of the most disturbing chapters in American history, one that will serve as the lasting legacy of the George W. Bush presidency. Jane Mayer has a current article in The New Yorker entitled The Insiders, How John McCain Came to Pick Sarah Palin. And it does seem, from reading your article, Jane Mayer, that the outsider, as Sarah Palin likes to call herself, was picked by insiders.
Yes, and she actually wooed the insiders considerably. I thought interesting was just that she has always cast herself as somebody who is kind of disparaging of the Washington insiders, and she always sort of calls them good old boys, and talks also about makes fun of the media elite especially. But in fact, she went out of her way to basically charm them and reach out to them in order to get picked to be vice president. So this is sort of the story of her wooing of them and their wooing of her.
Well, clearly the selection of Sarah Palin may be dissected, and there'll be a lot of forensic blaming, I think, after this election. If the polls indicate that there'll be a sweep by Obama, already you've seen signs of defections from within the McCain handlers of Sarah Palin. They've referred to her anonymously as a diva.
And a whack job.
A whack job was a stronger one. But then I thought a more pointed one was that somebody said her understanding of the issues, her lack of understanding of the issues, is dramatic. And it does seem that one of the things that I find puzzling about this is her numbers have gone down concurrent with every time she's appeared in any kind of press interview, particularly the Katie Couric one. And I assume, based upon that mathematics, that if she were to do a press conference, which they've assiduously avoided, she may well get wiped out. How come there hasn't been a kind of revolt in the press corps forcing the Palin's handlers to expose her to the American people as a possible future president? I mean, Fox ran a guerrilla campaign to force Obama to go on Fox Sunday. So I'm just curious as to why there hasn't been this sense that this is unacceptable.
Well, there was actually a campaign that was run that to push Palin to at least do interviews. I don't know if you remember this. It was the sort of Free Sarah Palin from Her Handlers campaign. That was the suggestion was that they were being sexist in not allowing her to speak for herself, and that did actually result in her doing the interview with Katie Couric. And I just think that even if the press was, you know, literally pounding on her door at this point, that the campaign can see it's such a liability to expose her to that kind of cross-examination that they wouldn't have let her do it anyway. I mean, the sense is that they realize what a problem they've got on their hands, and they're just not going to do it, so no matter how much pressure they were under.
Well, she did do Elizabeth Vargas, but that looked as though the parameters were pretty closely proscribed, and that ended up being a kind of softball waste of time, as far as I could tell.
Well, she'll do some friendly venues. But it's interesting, though, because basically what you hear from around the campaign is that she herself has such self-confidence that she wants to do more. She said, you know, she actually asked to do more with Katie Couric after the first interview. She wanted to come back. She didn't think she'd done well in the first round and wanted to do some more. And it's the campaign itself that sees the problem, and she does not see it. You know, she sort of doesn't know what she doesn't know, it seems.
Well, it's is this a case, though? Your article tells the story of these two ocean liners that went up through the passage up there to visit her in Juneau. The first one had a lot of the people from Rupert Murdoch's The Evening Standard, and then the next one was the National Journal. And different groups of prominent conservatives had lunch and visited with Sarah Palin. And her main champion, of course, has been Bill Kristol, who plays a prominent role in this. But is there something to be sort of interpreted here that these kind of handlers, these professional people in Washington who see themselves as kingmakers and the powers behind the scenes, are they such that they don't really care who the person is, that they are more important in effect than the candidate? Is that a possible explanation for why somebody so manifestly inadequate was thrust upon the stage like this?
Well, I think it's a very interesting question. It would be impossible to answer with any certainty. I mean, certainly Bill Kristol has been very important in promoting Sarah Palin, and he did come in the first cruise ship gang that came up through Juneau, Alaska. He was there with the Weekly Standard group doing a kind of a conservative cruise tour, and she was canny enough to invite him and the other pundits to come over to the governor's mansion, and she put on a great lunch and then took him and a few others on a helicopter tour. And by the time it was over, one of the other people who was up there, who I quote in the story, says, you know, they seemed smitten with her. Does he care whether or not she is substantive or not? It's a good question, because Bill Kristol is known as Dan Quayle's brain. So the storyline always in the past was that he was the brains behind Dan Quayle, and he didn't mind that Quayle was in some ways a host body, and it kind of makes you wonder whether he's looking at Sarah Palin as another opportunity for him to kind of be the brain power, and she to be the front. And in some ways, when they describe, when I talk to people at the campaign about why they picked her, they describe her very much in terms of her exterior packaging. They said, you know, it was great that she was a woman. They checked that box because it added sort of, you know, something new and something different. It was great that she was really pretty, and this obviously meant a lot to all the pundits. They were really kind of charmed and seemed to have crushes on her practically. And it was great that she was from Alaska, outdoorsy and something different and not from Washington. and a, you know, mother of five, and all those kinds of things. They were looking at the packaging, and they really didn't seem to pause too long over the intellectual substance there. Maybe they thought they could take care of that. It's certainly worth wondering.
Well, I bring it up because in the early days of the Bush administration, Richard Perle, one of the important neoconservatives, he said that what was most appealing about George W. Bush was essentially that he was an empty vessel that they could fill, and you know they did, and we got Iraq. And I guess the consistency here is that the neoconservatives are consistently wrong, and their original the description of a neoconservative was originally coined, I think, by Norman Pattoritz, who said that a neoconservative is a liberal who's been mugged by reality. But the truth of the matter is that the reality doesn't seem to affect the record. The reality of what they've done doesn't seem to affect neoconservatives. And I'm wondering whether this is a, you know, that they're not down and out in the sense that Sarah Palin is clearly. I've seen her on stage with John McCain, where she clearly, I think, feels that she's really in charge, and she almost sort of cued him with a microphone on one occasion, like, okay, buddy, you're on now, you know. I couldn't
believe
it.
Well, I mean, did you see, Saturday Night Live, you know, as well, where they did the skit, and she's busy sort of promoting herself for 2012 already in the comic skit. So, I mean, and I think part of what I was writing about also in the story was that far from being, you know, there's this myth that she came from nowhere and that she's the ultimate rube, you know, and that all she can do is sort of still dress a moose. And I think people would be naive to think that. When I interviewed people around her, including her former top campaign aide, a man named John Bitney, he said, oh, no, she had Washington in mind for a couple of years before this. You know, she had her eye on this. She's a very ambitious person. And she made all the right moves to get where she needed to go, basically. So, and including reaching out to and charming the insiders in Washington who promoted her, and they did it, you know, just perfectly for her. So when it came down to it, her name came from, you know, their lips to the candidate's ears.
I recall that the Chuck Todd, the NBC pollster, who sat in on the interview that Brian Williams did with both Palin and McCain, he went out of his way to describe the body language as being sort of hostile, and the extent to which Palin seemed to be confident and that the stage was hers, and she was upstaging her mentor, the protege was upstaging the mentor. So
well, I have the sense there's a great story still to be learned about what the dynamics are really like inside that relationship at this point between Palin and McCain. Because, of course, I mean, many of the polls show that she is the heaviest baggage that McCain has had to carry across this finish line, and particularly with independent voters. I mean, his choice of her and the way he chose her, seemingly without too much thought, which is also part of the story of what I tell in this piece. But those things have really hurt him, and you have to wonder, how does he feel about her at this point, and how does he feel about the aides that so convinced him to go for her?
Well, they were, according to your article, Jane Mayer, they were his inner circle: Steve Schmidt, Rick Davis, and Charlie Black, and and also according to your article, he barely met with her, and it was on the morning of the Thursday, the 28th, that he sat down with her, and he spent less than 3 hours in her company.
That's right, and I mean, and before that, I mean, before that, he spent somewhere between, you know, an hour and a half and three hours, I guess, really less than 3 hours, the day before he announced her as his pick. But before that, I mean, prior to that day before, he'd only spent 15 minutes talking to her in a crowded reception with other people there. He really did not know her. And so he was going on the advice of his advisors, and one of them, Charlie Black, apparently, according to David Keene, who was the head of the American Conservative Union, I interviewed him, and he said that he'd heard that Charlie Black had basically said to McCain, you know, if you don't pick her, you're going to lose. If you do pick her, you might win. they really felt they needed this Hail Mary pass, and that the other potential candidates, McCain was being told, were not going to do it for him. So he backed away from the choice that really was the one he wanted, which was Joe Lieberman, the former Democratic senator, now independent from Connecticut. And that was the man that he really felt most comfortable with, and it was also the choice that McCain's best friend on the campaign in some ways, Senator Lindsey Graham, who travels with him, wanted too. So, again, McCain, by choosing something that was not really what he wanted and not really true to his own nature, wound up with more trouble rather than less, I think you could argue.
Well, but preceding this choice, what seems to have happened here, which I've sort of gleaned from your article, Jane Mayer, in the current issue of The New Yorker, The Insider, is how John McCain came to pick Sarah Palin, is that the drumbeat to bring her to the attention of the conservative world, the kingmakers, the Schmitz and company, came from Bill Kristol, particularly on Fox News Sunday. It got so bad after a while, he kept plugging her so heavily that the moderator said, "Okay, enough of Sarah Palin. Can we please
change the subject?" Yeah, I know. It was really almost funny when you go back and look at the things that were being said about her. I certainly had it gone by me at the time, and when I went back to see what Bill Kristol in particular had said about her, he was calling her my heartthrob. I mean, he was being somewhat facetious, I think, but he kept pushing her over and over again. Same with Fred Barnes, who writes for the Weekly Standard, wrote the first sort of glowing piece about her that brought her to national attention. Then there was also an unknown blogger named Adam Brickley, who seemed to come out of nowhere, but in fact was very much a trainee of the conservative movement, who had received sort of internships and training from various places such as the Heritage Foundation and something called the Leadership Institute, which is a right-wing organization that tries to train cadres of the right to take power. And this young man, who's from Colorado Springs, Colorado, one of the homeschooled sort of evangelical Christians, just fell hard for Sarah Palin when he sort of Googled to find some sort of running mate that might be great for McCain from his standpoint, and started pushing her. And it spread kind of like this small flame that turned into a wildfire after a while on the right, and eventually worked its way through the various websites and then onto Rush Limbaugh and into the American Spectator, the kind of standard right-wing publications. And so there was this really kind of this underground campaign going on for Palin, Palin, Palin. And when McCain got down to the wire and was told he couldn't pick the man that he really wanted, who was Joe Lieberman, he kind of threw up his hands, and one of his friends described him as really angry that he couldn't have who he wanted, and kind of in peeve just said, "All right, well, who should I take?" And there was this groundswell from the right saying, "Palin, Palin, Palin." So he just kind of went with her.
Well, is there a kind of psychosexual component to this? I mean, you've got Michael Gerson, Bush's speechwriter, referring to her as a mix between Annie Oakley and Joan of Arc. That's relatively mild, but the neoconservatives, are, in terms of their zeal to go to war, often remind me of young boys playing with toy soldiers and not in any way cognizant of the real what really happens to the boys and girls who actually have to do the wars that these people imagine and promote. And, you know, people like Max Boot who still play with toy soldiers. But in this case, there's a sort of... their masculinity is so invested in this idea that she's a babe. Rich Lowry referred to her as she's the kind of woman that makes men sit up erect on their couches. I'm not making this up. And you get the feeling through your article, Jane Mayer, that all of these guys were just so excited by her. And
I kind of was amazed when I was interviewing everybody. These you know, very well, you know, they're certainly well-known pundits, and they're considered kind of intellectual leaders on the right. There's, you know, Victor Davis Hanson a conservative historian out from your part of the world, from California, who I mean, when he was talking about Sarah Palin, what he described was very much her physical presence, and it seemed to make a very big impression on them, it's fair to say. He talked to me about her twice. He mentioned that she was wearing high heels and kind of clacking around the governor's mansion up there in Alaska, saying, "Hi, I'm Sarah." And, you know, it sounded...
I'm afraid we're out of time here.
Well, it was very funny. Anyway, I hope you get a chance to read it.
Thank you so much for your article.
Glad to be with you.
Bye-bye. Bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking there with Jane Mayer, whose current article in The New Yorker is The Insider is How John McCain Came to Pick Sarah Palin. I'd like to thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the assistant producer, Elliot Fong, Melissa Figueroa, the engineers.